sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Avi Weiss, founder of the Open Orthodoxy Movement and author of the new book, Journey to Open Orthodoxy. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Freewald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I just returned from a trip to the East Coast to attend two Jewish weddings on Sundays a week apart, one in Massachusetts, the other in New Jersey. Both were lovely, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time away, much of it spent with family and friends. There's nothing like a chasana, a Jewish wedding celebration, to warm the heart and fill the stomach. In the intervening week between the weddings, I did a little East Coast traveling and was both blessed and cursed. Blessed with gorgeous late summer weather from Maine to New Jersey, not always the case in places like Boston and New York in August. It was sunny, clear, temperatures in the 70s and 80s, not humid, very little rain, delightful. On the other hand, since I had to do quite a bit of driving between various destinations, I was cursed with the reality of big city East Coast traffic, particularly in Boston, a city seemingly designed to create large, painful, endless traffic jams, especially around holiday weekends like Labor Day. In those settings, God is invoked frequently, but not very positively. Anyway, over Labor Day weekend, I had the opportunity to spend Shabbat in New York City and was reminded of the fact that Jewish life there is amazingly rich and diverse. I used to think that only in Jerusalem could you experience five or six different kinds of Jewish Sabbath services in a single morning, all within walking distance. Turkish and Italian and Aleppo Jews and the great synagogue with its choir and reform services and so on. But when I Googled synagogues around where I was staying in uptown Manhattan, it turned out that there was a Moroccan synagogue three blocks away and at least three Reform temples and a conservative one, plus a modern Orthodox shul, and of course a couple of Chabads, all within about six blocks. And if you are a Jewish religious variety addict, as I am, it was really fun to explore some of that diversity. Even if after Shabbat morning services I attended a very different sort of sanctuary, Yankee Stadium, to take in a Yankees game. And I'm a Dodgers fan. Still, it was great. I'm quite sure you could have assembled many minyanim for services that Shabbat afternoon and evening at Yankee Stadium. I also saw a great new Israeli-Palestinian film that night called Tel Aviv on Fire, which will undoubtedly be playing the Jewish Film Festival circuit this year. If you get a chance, watch it. Its central premise is that a Palestinian ne'er-do-well and an Israeli border officer end up co-writing a Palestinian soap opera. You kind of have to see it to get it, but it's entertaining and whimsical and sad and great. All in all, it was a very nice break before the plunge we rabbis and cantors all take in this month of Elul, preparing for the Jewish High Holy Days, just 3 weeks away now. To play us in this morning in preparation for Rosh Hashanah 5780, here's a classic High Holy Days setting of Avinu Malkeinu by Max Chinovsky from the cantors of Park Avenue Synagogue in, you got it, New York. Avinu Malkeinu Avinu Malkeinu. That was cantor Ozzie Schwartz of Park Avenue Synagogue singing Janowski's Avinu Malkeinu for the upcoming High Holy Days, 3 weeks from tonight. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Avi Weiss, is one of the most important rabbis in America and maybe in the world, the founder of Open Orthodoxy and two modern Orthodox yeshivot, including the seminary that ordained the first Orthodox women rabbis in history, as well as an Orthodox rabbinical organization, an innovative and extraordinary Jewish leader of great accomplishment, and an author of the new book, Journey to Open Orthodoxy. Meet Rabbi Avi Weiss when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Avi Weiss, is in many ways one of the most important figures in the Jewish world over the last couple of decades. He was the rabbi of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, the founder of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, the founder of Yeshivat Maharat, which is the first institution to ordain Orthodox women, and the creator of Open Orthodoxy. He has a new book, Journey to Open Orthodoxy, that's just out. Welcome to Too Jewish. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm going to start with my own experience just knowing about your work. I was quite certain that the first woman to be ordained in Orthodox woman to be ordained in Judaism would happen some years after the Messiah arrived. So when I heard about the work that you were doing, I was really quite stunned. Can you give us a little bit about what that experience was like from the inside?
Well, first, I was blessed to meet Rabbi Sara Horowitz, who's the first Orthodox woman to be ordained in an institution, Yeshivat Maharat.
I must add, a past guest of Too Jewish, by the way, too. So.
And she's just an extraordinary person. And when she was ordained, especially when Sarah assumed the title of Rabbah, which is the feminine equivalent of rabbi, we actually use the term rabbi, too, for those women who wish to use it. So there was a tremendous pushback, and leadership, the definition of leadership is change, and change is always resisted. There's nothing, I believe, in the history of humankind of value that involved change where there was not resistance. Even our own peoplehood, when Abraham and Sarah, when they discovered monotheism, they were really lonely figures. There was a tremendous resistance. When Dr. King spoke out for civil rights, freedom for black brothers and for his black brothers and sisters, there was a tremendous pushback. And that's the way of the world. So there was a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous pushback. But we weathered that storm. And 10 years later, Yeshivat Maharat, by next June, there will be 45 Orthodox women who will have received smicha, who will have been ordained. And many of these women are out in the world already serving our community, serving in synagogues. And now we've taken the step where some of the women are serving as senior rabbis. Dasi Fruchta, as an example, in Philadelphia itself, is assuming the responsibility of becoming a senior rabbi in a new synagogue. There's a lot that's been written about it and will be written about her brilliance and the way she's bringing such a powerful message of Jewish spirituality and open orthodoxy to the Philadelphia community.
It's an extraordinary moment, I think, and we will talk much more with Rabbi Avi Weiss about the creation of open orthodoxy and the changes that we're seeing in the observant Jewish world when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, events, and high holy days this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone through the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is now located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study with bagels and lox is at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us this Shabbat at 7315 North Oracle Road on the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our terrific religious school, high school, Torah Tikes program, Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and rich array of adult education academy courses, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning year and first High Holy Days. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started speaking last week about small Jewish communities that are diverse. Last week we had an example in Sevilla, Spain, of a small, very tiny, you know, kind of community endangered of extinction that somehow manages to have two completely separate Jewish synagogues going on that don't really interact at all. But there are other examples, counterexamples. You had one recently.
Right. The converse to Sevilla in every way. I spent a long weekend in Mendocino, California with old friends.
Beautiful part of the world.
It is absolutely gorgeous. Forest, mountains.
Redwoods, ocean.
The ocean, you name it, it's got it in abundance. And it has a surprisingly large Jewish community in the sense that Mendocino proper is a town of 1,100 people. So you don't expect more than maybe
a handful.
20 Jews.
Yeah, right.
But it's also the center of a region made up of a bigger town called Fort Bragg. It's probably five or six times as big, and several other small towns. So maybe 10,000 people. And one of my very oldest friends was a founder of the Mendocino Valley Jewish Community Center, or whatever it's called, which is actually a synagogue. They eventually, when they had enough people and enough money, they bought a church. They had all the crosses removed. They added a kitchen, because how can you have a Jewish institution without a kitchen?
We're dealing with that at my congregation Beit Simcha right now. How do you add a kitchen? That's
okay.
Always the key part.
And they have a school for kids. Although most people in this community are older, there are people who in other settings would be identified as Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox. Doesn't matter. They all come together. They have two Sifrei Torah. They have mixed seating, obviously, but if somebody wants to, they can sit off to the side and be in a section where they're the only man or the only woman. And they even have a synagogue cookbook. And the rabbi, who is a woman, wrote in the foreword to the cookbook, in a community this small and this diverse, we have to be inclusive. There's no choice, and everybody understands that. So everybody is welcome, gay, straight, black, white, makes no difference to us. Anybody who wants to be with us is more than welcome and can stand with us, and worship or celebrate or mourn, whatever's appropriate. So that actually reminded me of not only my hometown of St. Louis, but other towns like Seattle, whatever, in the 50s and 60s, certainly, when the Jewish community did things together, like observed Thanksgiving. There was a Thanksgiving morning service, which wasn't particularly a Jewish holiday, but it was a Jewish community observance, which included all the branches of Judaism.
Yeah, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform. And I remember that when I began as a cantor, it was very common to have these communal observances. And there wasn't a sense that, you know, and I, as a conservative cantor, I'd go to a Reform synagogue or an Orthodox shul, and I'd sing something in it. And it was normal. It was expected. Everybody participated.
Right. So the question is, in some senses, all right, you have Mendocino as a shining example of an exception to today's Jewish world. But what happened to that Jewish world you and I knew as youngsters?
Well,
and maybe we can discuss that another time.
Talk about that next time. But I also think that it may not be, it's a wonderful example, not such an outlier. And there are so many smaller communities in America that I've experienced. You know, you will have one congregation that has a Friday night Reform service and a Saturday morning Conservative service. And maybe there's some renewal elements, and okay, Orthodox life is difficult in those places, but people manage to come together and really create community across all of their differences. But let's talk about what happened in a more global sense next week. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Bernie is trying to pull out of a parking place, but to his horror, he bangs into the bumper of the car parked in front of him. To make things worse, the incident is witnessed by people waiting for a bus. So Bernie gets out of his car, inspects the damage carefully, takes out a pen and a piece of paper, writes a note, sticks it under the wiper blade of the car he hit, and drives away. This is what the note says. Hello, I've just hit your car and there are some people here watching me. They think I'm writing this note to leave you my name, phone number, and insurance information. But I am not. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and don't be like Bernie. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Danielle Levy and Shai Friedwald, young representatives of Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So, Danielle, you were saying that your biggest thrill in America is all of the different Ben and Jerry's flavors you can get here that
them.
You can't get in Israel.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In Israel, we have like 5 flavors, and here we have like 500. I don't know. So, yes, it's a big temptation. But we have to maintain a certain weight. So
after, well, you know, it's very is easy. Americans, we don't walk.
Oh,
we
yes.
eat a lot of, you know, rich food, mm-hmm. a lot of fast food. Not a good thing. Coming to America, you know, afresh, right, with fresh eyes. One of the things that people often say is like, there's so many choices, there's so much stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that? I mean, Israel has gotten to be such a commercial culture now.
Yes, but like in America, you have. In Israel, like where I live, I have maybe 2 fast foods next to my house, and that's
right.
it. And that's why we maintain like pretty like low weight, because you don't really have that many.
You're not eating junk
temptations.
All the time,
exactly.
Unlike
and here you have like in every corner like of the same restaurants, like every 5 meters. So it's really hard to just like
yeah. How do you not stop
it?
And get something?
Yes.
Shai, how about Ramat Gan's not exactly like the Emek Israel.
Yeah, you know, it's close to Tel Aviv, but
right.
in here everything it's so much big. You know, there's I shouldn't say that, but there is a vodka bottle that I saw. It was 2 liters, and it's huge amount of vodka or anything in here. It's so much.
Everything's in big sizes.
It's
in
big
America,
sizes.
Right.
Don't let me speak about Costco. I mean,
yeah.
No. My kids think Costco is my favorite place on earth. So you know, when you go there and you come from Israel, it's like, oh my goodness, what's going on here?
And we also made a challenge that in that year, we won't
eat McDonald's.
You
will
never eat McDonald's for the whole year.
I never eat McDonald's, so I won't have any difficulties. But my friend here,
Shai, this is you're giving up something really important here. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I know.
The you know, one of the interesting things for me, every time I go back to Israel, I see more English on signs, particularly in Tel Aviv, but interesting too, and even outside in the periphery. So how Israelis think they know English? Do you think Israelis really know English?
I think that's a bad thing about like the system in Israel, because we're being taught how to, like, the literature things, like the grammar and vocabulary, and people just don't really get to actually learn to speak English.
Speak the that's language, like the, right?
Like, yeah. Not that, but, that good, but...
Well, it's kind of like when I was in rabbinical school, we studied biblical grammar, mm-hmm. Tanakhit,
exactly.
Right? It's very interesting. It's helpful. You cannot
it's
get...
It's not useful.
You can't order food in a restaurant exactly. Using biblical yeah. Grammar, right? It doesn't work. So that's kind of... It's more of an academic approach, mm-hmm. Do you think?
Yes.
How did you guys get so fluent in English?
I guess for me, it's something that runs in my family, mm-hmm. Because I speak three languages fluent. My mom and my dad and my brother speak four languages fluently.
Because they remember Finnish too?
No, they speak French.
Oh, French, okay.
My uncle speaks nine languages.
Oh my goodness.
So I guess it's just something that runs in my family.
Yeah, Americans are really bad at languages, by the way. Shai, how about you guys?
Yeah, I just, you know, I watched a lot of TV shows and movies in English, like Wi-Fi Vogue, so Dano, and all the stuff. So, yeah.
And I watch Israeli TV shows now that we get them on Netflix. So,
Beauty and the Baker, for example.
Yeah, and Mossad and all of that.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe the cultures are coming together.
Yeah.
We will talk next week. Lihitraot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion that deals very directly with war, called Ki Tetzé. Most of us who feel positively about religion believe strongly that nations should live at peace, that war will someday become an ancient bad memory. They shall beat swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall men learn war any more, our prophet Isaiah predicted long ago. And almost every religion has similar injunctions, encouraging peace. Isaiah predicted this great time of peace 2,700 years ago, yet it still seems as far away as ever. The historical truth of human civilization is that a war is almost always going on somewhere, and sometimes everywhere in the world, that the number of years in which this planet has been free of war is very, very few. One calculation says that of the about 3,400 years of recorded human history, only 250 years have been free of a documented war. That is, once every 15 years or so, we have an entire year without war. To be honest, that seems wildly optimistic to me. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a single year in which warfare has not been waged somewhere on this globe. Which makes the agenda of the opening section of our Parsha this week, Ki Tetzé, sadly and strangely appropriate at any time. It does not begin Im Tetzé Milchama, if you go out to war against your enemy, but Ki Tetzé La Milchama, when you go out to war against your enemy. Pragmatically, the Torah treats war as a tragic but inevitable result of human conflict. We hate war. We seek to avoid war at all costs. We know that war is destructive to much of what we believe in and pray for. But we also know that there simply are times when it cannot be avoided, when in our fallible human way we will fall into war. Perhaps the best translation in the Torah here is, when you must go out to war. There's an old platitude, all's fair in love and war. Ki Tetzé informs us that all is not fair in war, that we need to restrain ourselves both in our military conduct and the ways in which we re-enter society. That restraint is essential to our moral claim to serve God through our own actions, to fight for the right. We are obligated to act in ways that sustain and reinforce holiness, even under the exigencies of military necessity. And so our section of Deuteronomy scrupulously outlines the ways in which we must restrain ourselves when forced to engage in warfare. We are not to destroy the productive capacity of the land of our enemies. We are not to exploit captives, women especially, as though they were subhuman. We are to have a cleansing process after battle before we re-engage in civilian society, a physical and psychological re-entry to give us time to readapt to civilian life. The contemporary Israeli army, the IDF, has its own code of conduct, the Tohorat Neshek, the purity of arms. It is a serious effort to reinterpret the concept of fighting the right way into practical terms. When Israeli soldiers fail that test, they are held accountable by Israel's own society. This makes the accusations of Israel's enemies more ludicrous when they claim the Israeli army is less moral than its counterpart militaries. The truth is the opposite of that. Faced with a continually challenging situation, the IDF may be the most scrupulously policed army in the world. It is not that Israeli soldiers are perfect. They, like all of us, are human and typically young. They are often placed in extremely challenging situations requiring decisions that can save or end their own lives and those of their comrades and fellow citizens. But Israeli soldiers are held accountable for their actions. They know it. They are trained to strive to act with appropriate restraint, even under severe duress. Perhaps the greatest lesson for those of us fortunate enough not to be engaged in military conflict is that if rules can be applied to the harshest forms of human interaction, warfare, they can certainly be applied successfully to the lesser friction and tsuris in human interactions we experience in our own daily lives. If our ancestors managed to avoid the worst excesses of warfare, perhaps we can learn to avoid the worst excesses our society presents us. The conflicts, arguments, and disputes that damage us, those around us, and our world. Instead of plunging further into hostility, we can de-escalate conflict. Instead of engaging in hateful exchanges on social media, we can disengage. In place of doubling down on personal attacks or insults, we can demonstrate restraint, judgment, and wisdom. Perhaps then, free of these excesses of conflict, we may resume our real task to create a world of holiness and blessing, in which someday Isaiah's words about the end of war and a time of permanent peace will really come true. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Avi Weiss, is one of the most important rabbis in America, the founder of Open Orthodoxy and two modern Orthodox yeshivot, including the seminary that first ordained women Orthodox rabbis in human history. Hear his extraordinary story about his journey to Open Orthodoxy when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will now serve as welfare minister in the wake of the resignation of Chaim Katz over charges of fraud and breach of trust. This marks the fourth ministerial portfolio, count 'em, that Bibi has assumed. In addition to being prime minister, Netanyahu adds the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs, generally known as welfare, to three other ministries he now leads: defense, health, and diaspora affairs. Katz stepped out last week following the announcement by Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit of him being indicted, unlike, say, Bibi Netanyahu. Katz remains a lawmaker for Netanyahu's Likud party, however. Netanyahu became Israel's defense minister following the November 2018 resignation of Avigdor Lieberman, head of Yisrael Beitenu. Netanyahu later dismissed Naftali Bennett, now the United Right Party, from the government back in June and took on his diaspora affairs portfolio. Yaakov Litzman of the United Torah Judaism Party resigned as health minister back in 2017. Not, by the way, for health reasons, but he remains deputy health minister. So in addition to being prime minister and running in the upcoming elections for the leadership of Israel, Netanyahu is the direct head of nearly a fifth of all of Israel's 21 government departments. It's like Donald Trump was also Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and, oh, I don't know, U.S. Trade Representative. I know Israel's a smaller country than the U.S., much smaller, but this is getting a little ridiculous now, isn't it? In Africa, in an unusual story we've been following here on Too Jewish over the years, more than 250 Nigerian youths and 20 adults gathered last month in Onitsha, Nigeria, for a week-long Jewish leadership and learning seminar organized by the Jerusalem-based Shave Yisrael organization and the Nigerian Jewish Youth Movement. The seminar included classes in Hebrew and Torah, lectures, Shabbat activities, singing and dancing. There are about 70 Igbo Jewish communities in Nigeria, founded at different times and under various circumstances. First and largest Jewish community in Nigeria, of course, is in the capital city of Lagos. It has been around for about 20 years. Most of the communities have at least one place of study or synagogue where members gather for daily and Shabbat services. The Igbo are one of Nigeria's largest ethnic groups, and among them, there is a minority of about 4,000 people who practice Judaism and consider themselves to be descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel. In recent years, a growing number of Igbo in Nigeria have chosen to embrace Judaism and seek to learn more about the culture, faith, and heritage of Israel and the Jewish people, said Shave Israel founder and chairman Michael Freund. We decided to answer their call. We're working closely with the growing numbers of Igbo Jewish communities now flourishing in places like Lagos, Abuja, and Anambra State. We will continue to monitor the progress of this most unusual Jewish community.
Didn't he tell you? Murray's our group leader, or as we affectionately call him, the Grand Zaftik.
Actress Valerie Harper died last week at the age of 80. Valerie Harper was famous for playing Rhoda Morgenstern on The Mary Tyler Moore Show, a huge hit in the 1970s. And then she was in her own successful spin-off sitcom, Rhoda. But Valerie Harper was not actually Jewish. She did play the first clearly Jewish lead character on a TV show since the early 1950s, breaking down a barrier that had existed across network television. Valerie Harper was the very New York Jewish character balanced against Mary Tyler Moore's prim protagonist. You're talking about Midwestern love. I'm talking about Bronx love, Rhoda told Mary back in 1972. There's a certain amount of guilt that goes with that. My mother wants the people she loves to feel guilty. Pretty Jewish. Harper was very much aware of how Rhoda's Jewishness informed her relationship with Mary. Describing her character, she said in an interview, "All I could do was, not being as pretty, as thin, as accomplished, was, I'm a New Yorker. I'm going to straighten this shiksa out." Before playing Rhoda, Valerie Harper was featured on the epic Jewish comedy album When You're in Love, The Whole World is Jewish, from which we here at Too Jewish have often borrowed material, including the epic song The Ballad of Irving. Valerie Harper won 3 Emmys portraying Rhoda on The Mary Tyler Moore Show and another one as the lead actress on Rhoda. She later went on to tour nationally in a one-woman show as Golda Meir in Golda's Balcony. Well, Valerie Harper wasn't Jewish, even if everyone thought she was, but she helped bring Jewish characters to prominence on television when we were completely absent, and that's worth remembering. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Avi Weiss. I have to admit, I'm a big fan. I don't usually say that to people I interview, but he is the creator, really, of Open Orthodoxy. His new book is called Journey to Open Orthodoxy, the first founder of the first institution that ordained Orthodox women rabbis, the founder of an important yeshiva, and really an entire movement in the observant world. So I want to ask you to explain, if you can in brief, your approach to halacha. People think Jewish law is immutable, nothing changes over time. That's not exactly your approach, is it?
No. I mean, Open Orthodoxy is committed to an understanding of the Torah having been given by God. So it is a belief in Sinaitic revelation. It is a commitment to the meticulous observance of halakha, but it's an orthodoxy which I call open. It's open, it's inclusive, it's non-judgmental, and it's loving. What would make it stand apart, I'll just mention a couple of factors, is there is a term which is bandied about called Mesorah. Mesorah is understood by some in the Orthodox world to mean that one must do today what has always been done in the past. But for me, Mesorah takes the past and takes past history and cumulative legal history into account when halachic religio-legal decisions are made, but Mesorah is a bridging of the past and the future. And that, I think, is the concept, that concept of Mesorah, which is a code word which has been misused to declare that all change is forbidden, for us is a concept that not only relates to fidelity to the past tradition, but as a process through which change can occur. Or yet another feature of Open Orthodoxy would be a very strong belief that halakha has built into it a system of ethics. It's not a system of ethical humanism, which would mean that ethics is dependent only upon the human mind and human reason is relative. We're so accustomed to saying that that which is wrong is right that we have a special word for it, rationalization. Joe Tulushkin often says that. But it is a belief that drachecho darchi noam b'chol nitzivoteh shalom, that the Torah is not a blind system. It's a system that cares deeply about the ethics of the world. So on a broad, broad sweep, I would think that those two issues, Masorah as the bridging of past and future, and the idea that we take ethics very, very seriously and struggle with the ethics of halakha, that really sets open orthodoxy apart. And then there, of course, are specific issues. You've mentioned one, our position on gender, our position in embracing and welcoming those in the LGBT community, recognizing that being gay is something that is built in. And there's only one time in the Torah where God says, Lo tov heyota adam levado, it is not good. Often the Torah says that God thought it was good. There's only once where God says it's not good. And that's when God says, Lo tov heyota adam levado.
Yeah, to be alone.
It's not good that, right. that the human being is alone. And if people are born gay, then open orthodoxy struggles within the halachic framework to find a way that people who are gay can live in companionship and in partnership. And while there are boundaries, and in orthodoxy there is no kiddushin, but two people of the same gender can live together in kedusha, can live together in a holy, uplifting, meaningful, intimate way.
The notion of open orthodoxy, that is a halachic commitment that's also open to the kinds of changes that are taking place in society, obviously, although it's very attractive to many people, has been opposed by others, including officially, I guess, the Rabbinical Council of America. Tell us a little bit about the struggle and how challenging that has been for you.
Well, you know, if there is no pushback, then I'm not sure one can do anything of significance if there is no pushback. So pushback doesn't mean you're wrong. Pushback could mean, in fact, that your idea may be
right.
correct. I remember when I was a very young rabbi, I was in St. Louis, and there was a person who came up to me as I left the Creve course, I left St. Louis, and he said, and he was a person with whom I enjoyed a very close relationship. He said, Rabbi, I bless you, you should have many enemies. And I looked at him, I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you know, because if in life you have no enemies, it means you've not done anything of value. And he's absolutely correct. And so there was a pushback. And I take the pushback very, very seriously, especially since it's within the family. These are my colleagues. The Rabbinical Council of America is made up of many people, many men. It's only men who are dear friends, who are really, really brothers. And so when I was criticized and life was so difficult that I left the Rabbinical Council of America, and I created with Rabbi Mark Angel a new modern Orthodox rabbinical organization called the International Rabbinic Fellowship, which now has over 250 rabbis. But when the criticism came, it was very painful. It was very hurtful. But having said that, I've spent very, very little time dealing with that pushback, with that criticism, because we all have just so much energy in life. And if I'm going to spend my time on that criticism, then I'm not going to have much energy left to do what has to be done. And that is to change the facts on the ground. And by this coming June, there will be 200 rabbis who have finished Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, the men's rabbinical school, and the women's rabbinical school, Yeshivat Marat, who have served in my synagogue, which is really the headquarters for all of this, the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. And 200 rabbis all over the country, literally everywhere. And I've come to understand that our goal in training rabbis is not to train followers, but leaders. And each lead in their own way and have had extraordinary impact. And they've really, for me, they've become my teachers. They've shown me the way. With all the criticism, every time I've walked into a classroom and had a chance to study and to learn, to teach and to learn from students or to visit their communities, I literally feel like I'm flying. I find it to be so uplifting. Right on the coast or in Arizona, there are rabbis who are really impacting our people and changing the world.
You've written, Orthodoxy for me is not a retreat to the inner sanctums of the synagogue or Beit Midrash, oblivious to what's happening outside the walls, but a much more outgoing and effective means of influencing the world for good. That's not always how Orthodoxy sees itself, is it?
Well, I can only speak for myself. For me, Orthodoxy is a commitment to the functionalities, if you will, of an Orthodox way of life. And so Shabbat, the Sabbath, and the dietary laws, and kashrut, and prayer, and tefillah, these are all very, very important elements, and we care about this very, very much. But I would say two things about it. One is that it's part of a larger mission. There are synagogues that I call functional synagogues, and that is that you're going to have a prayer service or you're going to have a learning program, and that's very sweet. But if you were to ask me what the mission of my synagogue is, I wouldn't say that it's to pray and to learn. I would say there's a larger mission. That larger mission is Vasita Yashav Atov B'nei Hashem. It's kimasot mishpat vavat chesed. It's doing good, loving kindness. It's a social justice, commitment to Israel, to the Jewish people, and to the larger world. And prayer and learning is part of that larger whole. And it's often the case that the functionality, the ritual, stands apart with it not being in tandem, in sync with being part of a larger mission, the larger mission of Eitz Chaim, he that the Torah is a tree of life. And the second piece is that for me, I, as an Orthodox rabbi, am absolutely, as it relates to one's relationship to God and one's observance, I am absolutely non-judgmental. I remember once being at a rabbinic convention and a rabbi, my senior, years back, said publicly, he said, Avi, you are so non-judgmental that for you, there is no such thing as a tzaddik or a rasha, no such thing as a righteous or a wicked person. And I responded and I said, I'm sure there is such a thing as a tzaddik and a rasha, but I'll let God make that decision. I'm not going to make that decision. And that really is a very critical part of my Orthodoxy. You know, this book, Journey to Open Orthodoxy, in working with the publisher, the cover of the book, the back cover, even though in ethics it says, Al tistakel bakankan, don't look at the cover, look at what's inside.
Yeah, look at the inside, right.
But the cover is important in the world today, and what you write on the cover is very important. And so what I write on the cover is that I'm outlining in this book a vision of open orthodoxy, and that open orthodoxy goes well beyond such controversial issues as women's ordination and LGBT inclusion. I don't believe in centralization of rabbinic authority because I think power in the hands of too few can corrupt. And also, as it relates to conversion, if there's a centralized body, it always moves to the most stringent part of the corpus of Jewish law, when the larger corpus of Jewish law is much more welcoming of converts. But I write here that this book is about that, but it's about much more. It's about an orthodoxy which is holistic. It's embracing the whole of Jewish spirituality. Spirituality is a very important piece of what open orthodoxy is about faith, the embracing of faith struggle, the embracing of and allowing one to be open and honest in one's feelings with God. My son recently finished a book on the theology of protest called Pious Irreverence. And one of his deepest teachings, which I've incorporated, is that when one argues with God or one is upset with God, that's not a sign of disrespect. It's a sign of love. The rabbis say, "Ein ahava she'ein imotachacha." There is no love without rebuke. It's only with somebody with whom I have a relationship, only someone whom I love, that I can be open and deep with my feelings. And then I wrote that my hope is that the reader will evaluate this book and assess his or her own journey, leading, it may be hoped, to a consideration of an orthodoxy that is inclusive, non-judgmental, modern, and open. And I realized that I wanted to put in another word, and that is the word loving. An orthodoxy that is welcoming and that is loving, that doesn't spend all of its time coming to conclusions of who is not from, who is not orthodox, or the synagogue that I'm not going to, but rather is embracing and welcoming and loving. That's what open orthodoxy is all about. And I hope that's the contribution I try to make here, to present a Judaism that it's broader, even though these cutting issues are very critical to me. But open orthodoxy is much bigger than that.
You know, we're running out of time, but I wanted to mention one very surprising little section for me in this book, an incident that you report on where you went to a mosque in what we would call the West Bank or Samaria after it had been desecrated by some Jewish attackers and had really quite an emotional connection with the people there. Can you just, without going on into the depths of it, that's not something that every Orthodox rabbi or any Jew would be comfortable doing. Tell us a little bit about what that reflects.
Well, as it relates to the incident, the mosque had been desecrated in the town of Yusuf. I believe it's Y-U-S-U-F. And I felt it was important to go to the town and to express our horror that it had been desecrated. And so I went with a colleague, with Rabbi Yair Silverman, and we were supposed to meet the mayor of that town, who at the last moment said he couldn't make it. And we came to the mosque, and we were surrounded by people, and when they saw our kippot, they were very upset because they had felt that it had been desecrated by Jews. And at that moment, our Palestinian Arab taxi driver jumped out of the cab when he saw that we were being threatened, and he said, "These are rabbis, and they've come to offer comfort." And he stood between us and those who were not understanding why we were there. And it's a moment I won't forget, and it turned into a wonderful moment. Part of the reason I call the book Journey to Open Orthodoxy is because I think life should be a journey. There are those who think that what one believes today, one should have always believed. Because if you're really an ideologue, you're a person of conviction, and so your beliefs remain flat, remain constant. I believe you can have convictions even as you evolve. And so I've evolved. I've evolved politically. I was on very, very far right politically on the Israel spectrum. I'm still on the right, but I'm on the right in a very, I pray, humanistic way. And that's not only true in terms of my commitment to Zionism and to Israel, but to the broader world. For me, a strong sense of national identity does not contradict universal consciousness, but it's a prerequisite to it. So I am a nationalist. I am a strong Zionist, and I believe in the words of Hillel, "Emein ani li mili," if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? But he goes on and he says, "Ukshani latzmi mo'ani," but if I'm only for myself,
what am I?
What am I worth? And so, after New Zealand, after that horror, so we went to the nearby mosque, and I literally entered into the building and stayed for the two-hour service, and the imam was kind enough to welcome me to say a few words. I feel this sense of universal responsibility to social justice, but without compromising on my responsibility to Am Yisrael, to the Jewish people and to the land of Israel. That's why I included in this book sections that deal with spiritual activism. sections that deal with our responsibility to remember the Shoah. And for me, very important, the last section, I say, they say, Acharon Acharon Chaviv,
the last section is most beloved.
For
yeah.
last, was on Israel and my sense of commitment to Israel, to a Jewish democratic state. And I hope the book will be of some meaning. And I hope it presents a religious message that people can read, whatever your denomination in Judaism, and even if you're not Jewish, I hope it touches the soul and sends a message that the Torah is an Eitz Chayim, it's a tree of life, whose goal it is to ennoble our lives, to lift. This is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful world that God created. As long as we do our share to help make it beautiful and more beautiful, that too is a section of the book, our covenantal partnership and relationship with God. As much as we need God, God needs us, and only in partnership can our people and all peoples in the world be redeemed.
I want to thank Rabbi Avi Weiss for a great visit here on Two Jewish, and it really is an extraordinary book, Journey to Open Orthodoxy. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Well, I'm not a I'm not a good salesperson, but
oh, I think you're pretty good, just by being yourself.
Thank you. I think if they Googled my name, you'll see a lot of controversial stuff too, because there's been pushback on the gender issues and other issues. So Google my name, or the book can be. One can get the book off, I guess, Amazon, and all the books that I've written, I write because I love to write, but I made a promise to myself that I've been able to fulfill, that I've never kept any money that I've ever made on a book. It's always been given to different charities.
It's fantastic.
And, not that the books that I write are bestsellers, but whatever does come in, it comes from a very deep place and, from a humble way of trying to do my small share to try to make a difference.
Thank you again. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be New York Times bestselling author Andrew Gross, talking about his new novel about World War II, The Fifth Column. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Jewish High Holy Day season. It's one of those around-the-world songs put together, this one by congregations, cantors, and choirs for the coming new year. Join us for the holidays at my own congregation, Beit Simcha, if you are in Tucson or anywhere in southern Arizona. Rosh Hashanah arrives September 29th and 30th, 3 weeks from tonight. Call 520-276-5675 to make reservations. No payment is required, although totally voluntary donations are, of course, appreciated. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
May this be a year of love and kindness.
May strangers come to be friends.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.